This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, a busy show. John Westra, economist with the LSU Ag Center, will discuss a record-setting year for Louisiana agriculture in 2013, although things are not as rosy for 2014. Also on the show, best-selling author Jennifer Senior with her book All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Also, Steve Myers involved in a lawsuit regarding the definition of family in houses in Baton Rouge before the Louisiana Supreme Court yesterday. Talked with him, and we'll hear from Southern University Law Center Vice Chancellor John Pierre. Now the news on WRK. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757. And we're joined to begin with John Pierre. He is the Vice Chancellor of the Southern University Law Center. He's held that position for the last 7 years. He's been at the Law Center for almost 25 years. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good to hear you, Dr. Pierre. Well, tell us what's going on the Bluff.
Well, we're having a wonderful symposium starting tomorrow entitled Quality Education as a Constitutional Right and the Role of Historically Black Colleges and Universities. And we're doing this in conjunction with the Journal of Race, Gender, and Poverty and the Southern University System, Southern University of Baton Rouge campus. All units of Southern University are really involved in this panel discussion workshop. We have plenary sessions and case studies. And the first day we'll be holding it at the Southern University Law Center at Alenwa Hall. And then in the evening on Wednesday, we'll have a documentary screening of a documentary that has not actually been released yet. It's called Freedom Summer. Is part of the PBS American Experience documentary series by Stanley Nelson, and that will happen at 6 o'clock in the evening on Wednesday evening at T.H. Harris Hall Annex. So we're really doing a lot of great things, and this is in conjunction with Freedom Summer 50th, which is part of a national celebration that will occur in Mississippi in June. This summer.
All right. Well, it's a big topic. Quality education is a constitutional right and the role of historically black colleges and universities. What is the role now of these universities? Has it changed?
It has changed to the extent that historically black colleges now are more diverse than ever before. Many people would be surprised at how diverse historically black colleges are, but essentially historically black colleges have always been vanguards for access and opportunity throughout this country. And that's the point we want to make, and it's also been affordable. Colleges that are historically black have been affordable, they've been high quality, and they have provided access and opportunity to many people who would not otherwise have had that access and opportunity.
The Southern Law Center is the most diverse campus in Louisiana. It's pretty close to being 50-50 black and white, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's very diverse, but more importantly, we have a growing number of Hispanic students and Asian students at the Southern University Law Center, so it's diverse across all spectrums.
And it's a school that produced not only the mayor of Baton Rouge, but the district attorney of Baton Rouge, the former governor of Louisiana in Murphy, Mike Foster, all of whom are graduates of the Southern University Law Center. Did you teach them?
I taught Governor Foster.
Did you? Was he a good student?
He was. He was really, really interested in the law, and especially as we were educating him about laws that he had signed into effect.
But even if he was not a good student, how do you flunk the governor?
Well, you can if he doesn't do well.
Did he make an A?
I don't remember because we do anonymous grading, so he never told me his grade, and I never knew. I never looked.
Really? Well, but he asked good questions in class.
Absolutely.
He took that seriously, and some faulted him for going to law school while he was the governor of Louisiana, but he's Mike Foster. He could do pretty much what he wanted, and he pulled it off.
Well, but more importantly, he set an example for a lot of individuals who would be considered senior citizens. And we have more senior citizens in law schools. We have a number of students that are above the age of 55 that are in law school. And also, he opened the opportunity for us to really do our part-time programs. And we have a really great part-time evening program for non-traditional students.
Yeah, that was not there when he was going to school. He had to go to school in the middle of the day, didn't he?
That's exactly right.
Well, how does the evening program work?
The evening program works where we have classes from Monday through Thursday from approximately 5:30 till about 9 o'clock. And if you just do it that way, you can complete law school in 4 years. Yes, right.
Okay. But it's a school that is flourishing. How's the rest of the university doing?
Well, as many higher education institutions in this state, struggling with respect to financing. I mean, that's one of the big issues that has faced higher education over the last several years. But I think that when we look at higher education that has weathered the storm, Southern University has clearly weathered the storm, we will continue to provide access and quality education opportunities for a lot of people, especially first-generation students.
We're hearing from John Pierre, Southern University Law Center Vice Chancellor. He's held that position for the last 7 years. And in a moment, we'll hear from a prominent student at the Law Center at Southern University. A question from Tracy at the Capitol wanting to know how many students are currently enrolled at the Law Center.
We have approximately 650 law students at the Southern University Law Center.
And you generally graduate how many per year?
About 160 per year.
160 per year, and they go out, and I would imagine most of them practice law in the great state of Louisiana.
Most do, but we have a lot of students that are practicing outside of the state of Louisiana because there are so many opportunities globally and outside of the state that students are taking advantage of it.
The bar exam has gotten real tough. It always was tough, but this past year was not good for any of the schools, was it?
Exactly. Louisiana is the second most difficult bar exam to pass, the bar exam in Louisiana. And there have been significant changes in the bar exam, the structure, grading, and I think there's just a lot that's going to have to be done to really address those issues.
What needs to be done?
Well, I think we need to look at things like the system of multiple choice questioning when that has not yet ever been done before. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of things that are going to be studied by the Supreme Court. So we'll wait to see what the Supreme Court says about it. And certainly there has to be some adjustments by the schools. And hopefully the Supreme Court will look at what needs to be done and make some adjustments that will affect those people who are taking the exam positively.
Mm-hmm. Well, the law scores on the bar exam were low for not only Southern, but LSU, Tulane, Loyola. Everybody suffered.
Yes, there was a significant drop in bar passage this past July. Yes, absolutely.
Well, what happens there? How many sections?
There are 9 sections of the bar.
Well, let's say I take it and I pass 7 of the 9. What do I need to do? Do I have to take all 9, or do I only take the 2 I didn't pass?
Now you have to take all 9 because
really?
There's no longer what they call conditional passing or conditional failure. You have to score a cumulative score of 650, whereas before under the old system, when you took and passed 7 parts, your cumulative score really only had to be 490. So that's a significant.
Okay, so that explains it.
Yes.
Well, we're joined in studio by Candace Williams. She is a student. Good morning, Candace.
Good morning.
Well, tell us your story. You're in what year?
I'm in my last semester of law school at Southern University Law Center.
And where are you from?
I am from Monroe, Louisiana.
Monroe's. And Monroe. Where'd you go to, what'd you do your undergraduate? Where did you go?
I stayed home, so I went to the University of Louisiana, Monroe.
And came to Southern for law school.
Yes,
and how's that experience been for you?
My experience at Southern has been amazing. I knew that I wanted to go to law school and that I had some interest in working for government at some capacity. And so I dually enrolled, and I'm working on my master's of public administration as well as my law degree. And it has been the first time that I've really experienced family as it relates to being in school. And so the tight-knit community is something that I really appreciate. The relationship that I have with my professors is something that I don't think that I would get at most other universities. And just having people to cheer you on and to push you is really motivating.
What was your undergraduate degree in?
Mass communication.
Well, you speak well.
Thank you.
That's a good degree. It's funny how many journalists end up becoming lawyers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
When I grow up, I want to be a lawyer. In fact, when Mike Foster went through the law school, I thought, well, this must be so easy that I'm going to try it. So I took the LSAT. I got accepted. I went through orientation, and then I realized this is really hard. It's going to take a lot of time. I don't have time for this. I don't know how he pulled it off. He must have had a little help along the way.
Well, he studied really hard. Plus, he had a lot of practical experience, and people discount the real significance of having practical experience. And let's just say that he took good notes.
Might have gotten a little personal instruction, too. But, Candace, what kind of law do you want to practice when you leave Southern?
I've had a lot of law firm experience, so I really enjoy doing contracts and commercial type transactions, but I'm actually interested in going to the Air Force and being a JAG officer, and so that's my ambition for post-graduation.
That's wonderful. 297-5633. Charles on North Foster. Charles, good morning.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Vice Chancellor, and good morning, Ms. Candace. I'm a graduate of Southern University, and I had a chance to attend a little university in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where Alan Dershowitz is a professor. And I saw him out handing donuts and coffee to some very upset Cambridge police officers during the O.J. Simpson trial. I was wondering, though, the Southern University Law Center, the students, are they involved in community issues like, for instance, education and the unfair application of the LEAP law and the GEE education standards for public school students?
Yes. Actually, our students participate in several pro bono projects and clinics. So we do a lot of clinics to represent indigent defendants. And exactly the issues that you just spoke about are sort of at the core of what we want to talk about in the 2 days. So some of the subjects that we're going to be talking about includes the litigation involving New Orleans teachers, the educational impact of the potential St. George breakaway or the breaking up of the East Baton Rouge Parish and the four sub-districts. We want to talk about the impact of Acts 1 and 2, other accountability measures. We're also going to have a panel discussion tomorrow on higher education affordability. And then on Thursday, we're going to have a lot of discussions about advancing education, such as what happened in New Orleans case study with charter school, recovery school district, and a lot of school desegregation cases and how they may have affected the access and equal opportunities as far as minority kids getting access to quality education in Louisiana. And we're also going to talk about some of the issues related to higher education.
We have an inquiry about the documentary, the PBS documentary, Freedom Summer. When will it be showing?
It will be showing on tomorrow evening, Wednesday, at 6 p.m. at the T.H. Harris Hall Annex.
Okay, that's T.H. Harris Hall Annex, tomorrow at 6 o'clock, Freedom Summer. Candace, do you have an appreciation for the history of the university and the struggles for people who have been in this state, people of color in particular, as a young person?
I do. It is amazing to see the work of people like A.P. Touro, who have made an impact and really helped with the foundation of what Southern University stands for. And from being a part of the symposium, I realized how close what he did really is to our generation. It only happened a few generations ago. The Southern University Law Center was founded less than 70 years ago to address the needs of students who were not originally allowed access to universities like LSU. And so I am greatly appreciative that the work of pioneers before me has allowed me to be able to have access to quality education at my own level today.
All right. Well, we look forward to seeing Dr. Pierre and Candace and many others in the next few days at the Southern Law Center. And remember, tomorrow night, 6 o'clock, at the T.H. Harris Annex, we'll see the Freedom Summer, the PBS documentary. It's really getting rave reviews. So thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.C. Kane is producing. And we're joined in studio now by Dr. John Westra of the LSU Ag Center. He's been there for a dozen years, native of Nebraska, and a PhD from the University of Minnesota, which produced Hubert Horatio Humphrey after he spent some quality time at LSU. So you've gone just in reverse of the former vice president of the United States. And in HHH's day and today, Louisiana remains a largely agrarian state. We, the urban people, we often don't appreciate that, but agriculture is still the largest industry in the state. And you say last year was a good year for the industry. Why?
Well, it was actually a record-producing year in many areas of Louisiana. Livestock, crops, and fisheries, and those are all three major components of the economy in our state. There were record years in terms of crop yields for a couple of key commodities in our state, record high prices for the beef cattle producers in the state, and marginal increases in production in the fisheries.
That doesn't translate to this year, though. This year, the numbers are not as rosy right now.
Well, they aren't for some of the commodity prices. That's correct. So prices are lower, but in some cases, it's hard for them to go higher than they were last year and the year before.
Now, John Westra is an ag economist with the Ag Center, and the industry pumped $12 billion into the Louisiana economy last year. That's a serious infusion of dollars.
It sure is, yeah. And that only accounts for some of the primary production, actual growing the crops, raising the livestock, catching the fish, and harvesting forest products, and that very first level of processing. So it doesn't include a lot of the other activities that I think most people think of when they think of the food and fiber sector. And that totals $30 billion in the state.
$30 billion.
Yeah. So the $12 billion that we report in the ag summary is just the raw production of those products and then that first level of processing, which is basically sorting, cleaning, grading, maybe taking stuff to a mill, whether it's a sawmill or a rice mill or sugarcane mill. Mm-hmm. But once that gets beyond that, that's where those other billions occur.
Is there a disconnect sometimes between life in the city and what's happening out in the farms of Louisiana, where people are working their proverbial rear ends off and trying to make things not only palatable for themselves but for the rest of us?
Well, I think that's a good question, Jim. I think oftentimes when we're on our way to work, stuck in traffic on the interstate, especially in an urban area, we tend to forget and don't see much of what's going on in the rural areas of the state. But it's a sizable portion of our state, and there's still a significant portion of the population that lives in rural parts of Louisiana. And I think one of the things that we try to highlight, and one of the reasons behind the Ag Summary that we put out every year, is to try and educate people about the important role that agriculture still plays in our state.
Well, that's the $12 billion, or right at $12 billion, is almost half a billion-dollar increase over the year before. So it was a substantial increase over 2012. How do you account for that?
Well, part of that increase, or the majority of the increase, let me rephrase that, came from a couple of key commodities. There were record yields for feed grains and soybeans, with prices that were about what they were in 2012. So with that substantial increase in production, that accounted for a portion of that $400-500 million increase in total value. The other part came from the livestock sector, poultry and beef cattle. And beef cattle in particular had a very good year in Louisiana.
And how does that translate to the overall economy?
Well, the ag sector does, when it's doing well, it's a reflection of consumer confidence and increases in purchases that are occurring. And so one of the things that we've seen is that over the last 4 years, the value of agriculture has increased just as the economy has been recovering. And also it helps boost economic activity in the state, which is beneficial.
And in other states, was there an uptick as well?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm sure in areas that had similar crops that were benefiting last year that we did, so the Corn Belt, for example, I'm sure did much better with those areas where they're growing feed grains like corn and soybeans. Livestock sector, though, in the Southern Plains in particular, where there were they've been suffering from droughts for the last several years, they have probably been suffering as well because they've had to liquidate herds, and so their cow numbers are down. So they didn't benefit from that price increase.
Dr. John Westra, 12 years at the LSU Ag Center. There have been some changes there of late.
There sure have been. They have been, consolidating administratively the Ag Center with the College of Ag, and so kind of getting back to the roots that were there when Hubert Humphrey was a student at LSU.
That was in 1940, so that's
quite a while back.
But I think as long as there's a Louisiana, it will largely be an agricultural state.
I think that's true. I mean, we have a lot of natural resources that are here. We're blessed with those. And one of the great things about Louisiana agriculture, as opposed to many other parts of the country, is that we have a diversity of crops, livestock, and fisheries that are harvested in our state. And that helps us tremendously in terms of weathering storms, weathering economic ups and downs. And so when you have a diverse set of crops, livestock, and forestry and fisheries, it helps boost your economic activities.
When hurricanes come through here, how does that affect the Louisiana agriculture economy?
Well, more often than not, it has an adverse effect on the state's ag sector. Usually what happens is we have flooding, storm surges in coastal areas, and that has a negative impact on rice and sugarcane in those areas and beef cattle like we've seen the last few times we've had hurricanes in the state. And then in other parts, in the northern part of the state, when those tropical storms diminish, they still have rainfall, and that sometimes impacts harvest of some of the major commodities up in the northern part of the state.
And a listener asks about the impact of the BP Deepwater Horizon tragedy of 4 years ago. That certainly affected agriculture.
Well, it affected fisheries landings specifically. And what we've seen is that last year, or 2013, the numbers that are reported in the Ag Summary are actually from 2012 because of the way the data's developed and delivered to us. We showed there was an increase, although the level of response and recovery isn't as to the level of what it was prior to the BP oil spill.
So what kind of a cost? Can you measure it as far as actual dollars?
Well, in the fisheries, one crude way of looking at that would be what the difference in revenue associated with landings is today, last year, and the year prior, based on what it was prior to the BP oil spill, and come up with a measure of the difference in that. That's one way, but that would only look at some of the fisheries landings. It wouldn't look at things like tourism and other activities associated with coastal Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Ag Center is involved in intricate things involving agriculture in Louisiana, and we, as Mike Martin, the former chancellor, noted in Louisiana, I think we're the only place in the country where we have two ag centers in the same city from as far as universities.
I think that's true.
Barry in Mid-City. Barry, you're on the air with John Westra.
Yes, just able to tune in, and I wondered if you had a chance to talk about the impact of what's going to be happening, God willing, with the energy expansion in America, fracking, and so forth, and its impact.
What about fracking? Is that going to stimulate agricultural endeavors?
Well, I don't know if it's going to stimulate agricultural endeavors directly. I do know that some of the landowners in areas where fracking is occurring have definitely benefited financially from sales. From sales of fracking mining rights to those firms that are doing that. And so sometimes that actually affords landowners an opportunity to try things that may not be as profitable on that land because they've got other income streams. And so it may actually have an impact on agriculture, but we don't know whether it's going to be positive or negative.
Okay. Well, we thank you for joining us, Dr. John Westra. Appreciate the work you do at the LSU Ag Center.
You're very welcome, Jim. Thank you.
And we're joined now by Mr. Steve Myers, the person who was in the Louisiana Supreme Court chambers yesterday, along with his lawyers and lawyers for the city parish of East Baton Rouge. And the dispute is over the definition of family by the Louisiana Supreme Court. What happened in New Orleans yesterday, Mr. Myers?
Well, it was a really good show. I think the justices were quite interested in the case. There was a oil and gas case right before us that was a little bit boring, and they were really engaged by both sides. You know, a lot of people have never been to the Supreme Court and don't understand how it works. You file all kinds of briefs in advance, and our briefs in the were excellent. They can be found at themyersmessage.com if someone wants to find the background on this. But theoretically, the justices are prepared. They understand all the background, and they're looking for more nuances. So they really grill the attorneys for both sides. And both sides, I think, got their share of the justices' attention.
Well, the issue is whether the definition of family that the city parish uses in its zoning ordinances is constitutional. This is a issue that's been burning, and I mean burning, for a couple of years. We almost had an altercation between Myers and his adversary, Paul Nakhan, in this studio 2 years ago. Do you have any feel on how the Supreme Court will rule? You got a favorable ruling,
you know,
from Judge Clark.
Well, Judge Clark, the law is unconstitutional. Judge Clark recognized that and ruled it as unconstitutional in the 19th Judicial District Court. The city parish appealed to the Supreme Court. You skip the First Circuit when an ordinance is constitutionality is at stake. But one thing I learned from Professor Beyer at the LSU Law Center is that you really should not gauge what a decision will be based on the questions a justice asks at both the Louisiana mm-hmm. or the U.S. Supreme Court, because oftentimes they are trying to refine their own position, you know, get rid of some clutter in their mind as far as whether their position is right. So, but looking at the way the questions went, and I think the article in the NOLA.com this morning, you know, pretty much nailed it, as it appeared from the questions that three of the justices or four of the justices seemed to favor upholding the rule, and three of them had a little bit more concerns. But note that the concerns were on other issues. I mean, you can decide a legal case on a lot of different issues other than what is right, you know, in the natural law sense.
Well, Steve Myers is a lawyer and the founder of Tiger Bag Magazine, and he owns how many properties do you own and operate in our community now?
Enough to pay the bills.
About 50 or 60, something?
It's about 50.
50, okay. The case involves around a Cherrydale Avenue home that he rents to four young people. A neighbor, Paul Nakhan, complained to the city parish about the home being rented to unrelated residents. Now, you have claimed that Mr. Nakhan has tormented the residents. He denies this, but there is a dispute about whether or not what you're doing is legal. Under the law as it's defined now, is it legal?
I'm not sure I even understand the question, because that's what we were in court about, is to determine whether the law is legal. You cannot violate an unconstitutional law. So the question before the
court. Well, now that Judge Clark has struck down the law.
Oh, you're talking about under Judge Clark's ruling, right?
Is it legal based on what you're doing
right
now?
It was legal before. What I was doing was legal.
Based on your interpretation. Now, today you were the talk of Louis, the buzz in there from Steve Covert, by the way, who once had his own issues in the same neighborhood when he really enhanced the neighborhood by bringing in a couple of beautiful homes, but the neighbors objected.
Yeah, including the same pitchfork crowd that says they say at Louis's this morning
that there is now on one of your properties on Morning Glory a sign that says Section 8. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, that's there. Here's the problem. They think that this definition is going to change conduct. And for 20 years, I've been trying to get the Metro Council and the parish attorney to look at this definition and to start judging people's conduct as opposed to their relationships. Mm-hmm. And you can conduct, when you look at constitutional law, the purpose of this is supposedly the legitimate government purpose is to have areas where there's quiet solitude and fewer cars and so forth. But the reality is, under the current definition, there's no limit on the number of people you can have. And if you put a family in with 10 people, that is perfectly legal, but you can't put three nuns in.
Okay,
so to answer your question, yes. I mean, they think they're...
You're offering Section 8 housing on Morning Glory?
I offer Section 8 housing where it can be offered in order to pay the
Morning
bills.
Morning Glory, Cherrydale.
Let me just say this, is that if Section 8's vouchers will pay for the rent, I will rent to any of my properties to a Section 8 property. The point that needs to be understood is that a Section 8 family, which I have one in Broadmoor, there were four police cars there last week because of some issue, but if that's what it takes, that's what we'll do. The point that people need to understand is that these areas are not going to drive rental property out of the neighborhood. They really are opposed to rental property when one-third of the units in Baton Rouge are rental property. And some people just don't want to live in an apartment. They want to live in a house.
All right. Here's a question from Mariano asking if this ordinance is enforced citywide or is it enforced in some areas and not others?
It is enforced in some areas against and not others, against some people and not others. Even the parish attorney to the Supreme Court. In fact, I saw a comment that said he perjured himself because he made the comment that if you have two people and three foster children, which would be illegal, that they just won't enforce it against those. So what he was basically saying is that we decide who is a desirable and who is an undesirable. Now, under constitutional law, when you have that kind of vagueness, the law is no good. You need to be able to read the law and decide who it applies to and who it doesn't without going to the government for permission to ask permission. Can we rent our house to these people? Do you consider them desirable or do you consider them undesirable? And in that neighborhood, college students are considered undesirable. Young professionals are considered undesirable. Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that I had one group with a lawyer, a CPA, and a vet driving a Mercedes, a BMW. This is a true story. And So technically, if those people were unrelated, I never know because I have a don't ask, don't tell policy. But the reality is that they were good neighbors. Some of them ended up buying in the neighborhood because they got so enamored by it.
All right. Well, the ordinance says that only a, quote, single family may rent homes in A1 zoning districts. Which is the or two or more persons who are related by blood, marriage, or legal adoption. The trick is more than two. More than two. Together, if the owner of the property lives in the home, it prohibits more than four unrelated people. We'll talk a bit more with Steve Myers. We'll also hear from Esther Moffitt, Jennifer Senior. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. J.C. Kane producing. A few more minutes with Stephen Charles Myers, who is embraced or embroiled, might be a better term, in a lawsuit that has now reached the Louisiana Supreme Court. The High Court yesterday heard arguments from Mr. Myers and his attorneys and from Paul Nakhan and his attorneys regarding what is the definition of family and how is it applied in Baton Rouge regarding, I guess, primarily rental homes, although it could involve homes owned, like the way the law is crafted, it could involve homes that are owned by a single person who has several unrelated people living there, right?
With all due respect, and I know this is a blatant promotion, but if people would go to www.themyersmessage.com.
I think you've already said that once.
Yeah, I'm going to say it again, www.themyersmessage.com. We put every pleading in this case essentially on the website because one thing about the law is it's very precise. I mean, we were talking about semicolons and commas to the Supreme Court yesterday because in the actual definition is on that site as well as all the pleadings. One of the justices, you left out part of the definition, which says there also has to be a single culinary facility and operated on a nonprofit cost-sharing basis. One of the justices said she had three kitchens in her house, which basically would mean that she would be prohibited from renting her house in some ways under this ordinance. The country club and the university club have multiple kitchens. So there's
If she lived in Baton Rouge,
right. So there's a lot of nuances to this law that make it difficult to do in a short period of time.
Well, do you think it's being enforced irregularly and unfairly? Is that part of your claim?
Well, they admitted that.
Do you think that?
Well, yes, of course.
So this isn't being enforced, say, in Scotlandville?
No. They say they operate on a complaint basis, which means that they don't even go looking for complaints like, say, they would at a speed trap. They basically wait for some busybody to make a complaint. You know, we have several solutions that we're going to propose to the Metro Council because, you know, people, we are not against A1 zoning. We're for it. This doesn't affect A1 zoning. It only affects what the definition of a family is. I noticed your first guest said that she felt like she was in a family at the Southern University Law Center. Well, is that a family or is it not? So that's really the question. And I tell you, it's like a song that gets stuck in your head. If you go to the website and look at all of the different possibilities and hypotheticals that the landlord has to deal with in renting his property, once it grabs you and you start thinking of all the hypos like the one you just came up with, it's almost unlimited. And that's why the law is vague and unconstitutional, because a normal citizen cannot rely on it and know what conduct is expected.
All right. Well, we'll see. The Supreme Court could rule in as quickly as 6 weeks, and I'm sure we'll hear from Mr. Myers, and we have invited Mr. Nakhan to be on the program as well. Thank you, Steve. 297-5633 is your number, and we're joined now by best-selling author Jennifer Senior. She's a contributing editor at New York Magazine, lives in New York City, and she has a book that is on the charts as a bestseller, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Nice to talk with you. I'm doing well. Well, you note in your book that parenthood as we know it has gone through some transitional definitions over the last generation or two. What's happened to parenthood?
Yeah, so I'll give you a few things that I think have really changed parenthood. One, and maybe the most significant one, is a historical one. And no one ever thinks about this. You know, no one ever goes, oh, gee, I'm living in the midst of this huge historic transition, and that's what's making my life so complicated. But I think in some ways it's truly what's happening. Kids used to work, and it wasn't an ethical arrangement, but it was what it was. And until 1940, 50% of all American boys didn't even complete high school. I mean, kids were really economic assets in families. So what they did is they existed alongside us, you know. We did not think about, quote-unquote, parenting them in the sense of a verb. And, in fact, the word parent didn't become a verb until 1970. Once kids became a sheltered, protected class where, you know, education was their primary focus, which was the right thing, lives for parents changed because very quickly they stopped working for us, and within a matter of decades we started working for them. It was fine during the 1950s when America wasn't very competitive and the world wasn't globalizing and the middle class wasn't shrinking. We were very prosperous. It was fine. You know, we didn't have to aggressively nurture our kids. They could go out on their bikes and play in the streets and come home at 6 o'clock for dinner. Once the world began globalizing and the economic prospects for the middle class began shrinking, parents started feeling this enormous pressure to cultivate their children. And I mean to really, you know, work double shift, right? So that we went from kids being our farmhands and bringing in second incomes to us now driving them to soccer practice and to chess lessons and to, you know, Suzuki violin and us checking their homework. And it has translated into an enormous amount of effort for us, so much so that mothers now spend more time with their children than they did in the 1960s when mothers were not in the main in the workforce, which is, if you think about it, an astonishing statistic. And it's a meticulously compiled one. It's from the American Time Use Survey based on tens of thousands of families participating. So that's a big change. You know, another big change is that both parents work now. You know, both are in the workforce. Statistically speaking, odds are if a mom has a three-year-old or older, she goes to work, like, outside the home. I mean, all moms work, whether they're in the home or not. But, you know, and that has created tons of, you know, tension between couples. There's arguments about who does what. Our questions about domestic labor have not been solved. These are massive issues that create marital strain. They also, you know, are costly because they require finding alternative child care arrangements, you know, and that's very painful. So those are two very big changes. I think another is just that we feel responsible for our kids' happiness, something that never occurred to parents until the 1970s. In fact, being happy wasn't even an aspiration until really the 20th century. You know, people were just sort of trying to survive before then. But that is a very hard thing to ask a parent to do, to make a child happy.
Well, you quote a sociologist in your book as saying that children today, Jennifer, are economically worthless but emotionally priceless.
That's it. I mean that was a very ruthless way of describing the economic transformation of a child. I mean, I think they've always been emotionally precious to us. But as I said, they used to just exist alongside us. There was an automaticity to what we did. You know, we woke up in the morning and didn't think, how will I best parent my child? We thought, what can our child do for the house? You know, and we loved them dearly, but we also had many of them. You know, in the Plymouth colonies, I guess, or in Plymouth Colony, there were 8 kids per family. In 1850, I guess there were 5 kids per family. And now there are 2. So imagine how priceless you consider your children now that you only, on average, have 2 of them.
Uh-huh.
You assign this enormous emotional weight to who they are, and you want to get parenting right, and you want them to be happy. You want to optimize the experience for everyone involved. But that's a lot of pressure. People have also waited a much longer time to have children. A woman, if she has a college degree, the odds are she will have her first baby at 30.3 years old. So just imagine how much, you know, sort of time she's had to enjoy her freedom and how much she's been looking forward to this life change, right? This is where, like, emotionally priceless comes in. You are assigning a great deal of weight to this experience by having waited so long to have this kid. So it's a very different experience, and we have very different expectations out of parenthood than people did. Even in the 50s, when people were having more children, they were not, you know, that was a rare kind of blip in American life when there were, you know, more families with 3 and 4 and 5 children.
The book is All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood from Jennifer Senior. And this is in the bestseller numbers. It is rising up in, I think it's made the top 10. All Joy and No Fun, according to Daniel Gilbert, is an indispensable map for a journey that most of us take without one. Brilliant, funny, and brimming with insight, an important book that every parent should read and read again. Now, you note that fathers spend 3 times as many hours with their children now as they did in 1965. How has this transformation occurred?
It's been intense. I mean, first of all, it's amazing, right? I mean, fathers now spend more time with their children than, I mean, their fathers ever spent with them. And it's been a real boon. And also, another thing about fathers, they now report more work-life conflict than mothers do, which is just fascinating. They are so desperate to be good, involved dads. You know, they want genuinely to be parts of their kids' lives and to not be stick figures. I think they meet more resistance in their places of employment. There are fewer places that offer paternity leave, or they offer shorter paternity leaves, you know, to dads. And I think there's also just a culture where, you know, it's just not quite as safe for fathers to say, oh, God, I got to pop out of here and pick up my kid because he, you know, because he's sick. The flip side of this is that because dads are involved, in a funny way, it's created more tension between couples because no one can figure out what percentage is appropriate, right? Men work more paid hours on average than their wives. Women do more childcare than their husbands. They do twice as much. In fact, that's the conservative estimate from the American Time Use Survey. So you've got couples fighting about who's doing what. Well, I was at work for a really long time. I need to come home and I need to decompress, says the father. And the mother says, well, I was working too today, you know, and I'm working double time with the kids. I need to decompress. So that's very complicated. It also turns out that fathers and mothers experience their home time much differently. Fathers do not tend to do the time-sensitive stuff at home. They tend to do the stuff that has a little bit more leeway in terms of deadlines, like the yard work. They do a lot of repair work. They often do a lot of things that are more interactive, like, you know, they play, they do catch and stuff. Whereas this is surprising to me. I didn't realize this from the data, but it's unequivocal, and it's very surprising. Women are the disciplinarians. They are the ones who are, like, sitting there wagging their fingers saying, your homework needs to be done by 8. You know, your bath needs to be done by 9. And, you know, they're the ones who are making the dinner still in the main. And this creates a sense of, you know, kind of discombobulation, I think, among women that their husbands might find hard to, like, relate to. That, like, they are simultaneous. When they're at home, they tend to be multitasking. Whereas fathers are multitasking when they're at work and not when they're at home. So there's this kind of new evolving tension that still hasn't been resolved.
297-5633. We'll try to get a few inquiries in for Jennifer in our remaining time with her. The best-selling book is All Joy, No Fun from HarperCollins, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Here's an inquiry from Leslie Todd saying, I love this book, recommend it to all my therapy clients. I'd like to ask Ms. Senior whether she thinks divorce and the resultant competitive parenting is another factor in the anxiety bond between parents and children. Your thoughts, Jennifer?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I'm sorry, just repeat the last part. I lost you for a minute.
She
asked if
divorce is another factor in the anxiety bond between parents and children.
Oh, interesting. Yes, and I talk about that in some parts of the book, but probably not as much as I would have liked to if I'd had more time. In particular, I think if you are a divorced parent, and if you are a same-sex parent and you are spending time with your kid, you become very, very bonded to them. And adolescence is especially hard on you because, you know, your kid is then rejecting you or spending less time with you at the very least. And there you are, and you don't have a spouse to give you the sustenance you might need, right? Your kids were these tremendous sources of affection. So particularly during the adolescent years, that can be very traumatic, I think. You know, and let's say that not only are you not married, but you also might not, for instance, have a job you like. You might, again, be over-investing in your relationship with your kid. So I do think that that's to some degree true. I mean, I'm not really well-equipped to weigh in on what the effects are of divorce on kids. There's, like, a very big, well-developed body of literature.
Well, you know, as far as parenting, though, there are many more single parents now than there were before in 1965, you have this fascinating statistic that American women 50 years ago didn't usually work outside the home, and yet today, when most mothers do, they spend 4 hours more per week than mothers of 1965 did to providing child care. And then if you're a single parent, the obligations and responsibilities are compounded, aren't they?
Well, exactly. They have to do, they have to do the labor for two, right? And there's just one of them. And as you very shrewdly picked up from my book, exactly, American women are already spending more time with their kids than they did in the 1960s, which is astonishing because this kind of full saturation immersion model of play has really, and of extracurricular kind of, engagements, has become the standard. So now just imagine you're, a divorced mother. And divorced mothers, if you look at the numbers, they have the least free time out of anyone. They have the least amount of social, socializing time. They spend the least time on dinner, dinners with friends. So that also, you have to imagine, kind of takes a toll on the psychological health of the caregiver, right? So that's going to also have an effect. It's going to be very hard all around. So, yes, in short, she's right about that.
All Joy and No Fun is the book from Jennifer Senior. I'm sure you're pleased with the response. It's been remarkable.
It's been really nice. What I like is when people read it and say that it's validating. I try never, ever to pass any judgments on any configuration that any family has cooked up because we are all working without a script, So if you're improvising, you're just doing the best that you can. So I steer very far away from wagging my finger at any human being. There's a gym chain up in New York that I think is national called Crunch.
All right, we got to roll, Jennifer, but thank you so much, and congratulations on a fine book.
Thank you very much.
And we shall return tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.